César de León in this lawsuit. To be clear, the petition alleges that he tortuously interfered with GMS's prospective business relations with the city through his actions during city commission meetings when the city rejected the GMS contract on the March 7, 2017 meeting and awarded a contract to Republic on February 5th and March 16, 2019. That's all they complain about, is his actions on the city commission. There's two issues that we have, and both of them are more procedural than substantive or merit-based. The first is objection to Judge Pate, required automatic disqualification, and the second is entitlement of Mr. De Leon to dismissal under 101-106. Late yesterday, we provided the court with a timeline of our objections to the visiting judge. If the court did not get that, I do have extra copies.
We all have them.
We have it.
Then I'll proceed. Working off of that, Your Honor, I'd start off by saying May 6, 2019, that's when Judge Rincon has signed the TRO and recused herself without reference to a provision of any order of assignment of Judge Pate. Now, she couldn't assign Judge Pate at that time because by signing the order, she was saying, I have not yet recused myself. She's still on the pleadings. She also does not have the authority to assign Judge Pate. Only the administrative judge, Missy Medery, would have that authority. There was no document yet signed. I believe the actual order of assignment was done after she had signed her order, her TRO. Now, we could not yet object to Judge Rincon's order, object to the appointment of any judge, because it had not yet happened at that point. And that would be supported by Justice Hinojosa's opinions in both the McCann and the Smith case, which were decided in August and November of this year, in which plaintiffs tried objecting to the appointment of any judge. And she said, those were premature, you can't object prematurely, and it has no effect. We can't object until we actually get that order. Now, we continued to May 6th, later that same day, Judge Pate was assigned as a visiting judge. The following day, Tetro and De Leon are served with process, May 7th. May 13th, the court sets an order setting the hearing on the city's motion to quash. The following day, May 14th, that's when, by that point, I got appointed, assigned to the case. I go and look at the court's file. Up to that point, nobody had provided either Tetro or De Leon with a copy of the order of assignment signed by Judge Missy Medery. Now, I go look at the file. At that point, I see it in the file, and at that point, I cannot deny actual notice. At that point, I've got actual notice of the assignment. On that same day, GMS requested a status conference, a new date for the temporary injunction hearing, an extension of the TRO. The following day, May 15th, GMS again requested a status conference, and the court sua sponte advised that it was not available for the temporary injunction hearing that had been set for May 20th, as originally scheduled. It extended the TRO. It reset the TI hearing to May 30th.
When you say sua sponte, are you just receiving a communication?
It's a letter.
From the court?
It's basically a one-page letter. That would be... I didn't include the reference, the page, I think it's at 3, court record 1419.
Okay, I have it.
Volume 3, page 14.
So you're just saying it was a letter received. So here's the part of the rule that we're addressing this morning under section 74.053C. An objection under this section must be filed not later than the seventh day after the date the party receives actual notice. So you're within your 7 days, let's assume.
Yes, Your Honor.
The actual notice. Or before the date the first hearing or trial, including pretrial hearings, commencements, whichever date occurs earlier. The presiding judge may extend the time to file an objection under this section. So are you saying that there is no hearing or no objection entered on May 15th?
Well, there is no hearing.
There's no hearing had been, there had, put it this way, we objected on May 16th, the following day. And that's when we filed our answer and an hour later filed our objection. Prior to May 16th, no hearing had been had. There had been no hearing.
So I assume that GMS files a request for a status conference via, document.
They filed a motion.
A motion.
I think it was either a motion or a letter request.
Okay, but there was no setting on that motion.
That's correct.
So the court gets the motion, realizes, I guess, that he is not available, and he, sua sponte, says, I'm not available, and I'm extending the TRO because the TRO would have expired had he not acted at that point.
And that's what he was requiring on, I presume, for saying there was good cause for extending that TRO.
But you all were not there. You all did not, there was no teleconference.
There was no physical or oral communication between any of the parties.
Is it true that only Jessica Toutre filed an objection to Judge Pate and no one else?
That is correct.
Okay, so no one else filed an objection.
That is correct.
Is an objection by one party an objection to all parties?
It's not so much an objection as one is to all. It's an objection as one doesn't matter if anybody else does it after that. An objection to one under the Castillo case and In re Parrott, because an objection was timely, assignment to the judge's disqualification was automatic. That's a Texas Supreme Court case. Had any other party filed their own formal objection, it would have added nothing for the court's consideration, and joinder in the objection to the trial court was not necessary.
Yeah, it's so automatic.
It's automatic. It's not that everybody else, it applies to them. It's just automatic. And remember, 74.053 allows each party an objection. Their interpretation would be that, no, everybody has to join in it. Well, if you think about it, everybody has to join in it. That means there's one objection per case. Mm-hmm. Because if they didn't all join in it, then they don't have a right to do it again later. In other words, they object to one and I object to one after that. Well, under their interpretation, if I didn't object to their first one and it goes forward, I don't have a choice anymore. I didn't join it. In other words, it's nonsensical to try to say that everybody has to join in, and that's what the Texas Supreme Court had said in Ray Parrott. Significantly, that order or instruction from Judge Pate was within 7 days. I'm sorry, we objected to his order within 7 days of the assignment and the date of the first hearing or trial, including any pretrial hearings pursuant to the government code. But his order, it did not. Let's see.
So I want to make sure you're saying that your actual notice doesn't, your clock doesn't start running until you received actual notice, which was on May 14th.
And that's from the actual literal language of the statute. It requires actual notice. If you look at it, it says under 74.053.
Actual notice.
Must be filed that later, 7 days after date, party receives actual notice of the assignment.
You don't think you receive actual notice at the time that your party is served with the petition on May 7th?
No, you're
right. Do you have any case law that supports as to what actual notice means?
Well, actual notice means actual notice. There's got to be some basis.
When a party gets served, this is the argument to be made. When you're served with a petition, you now are party to a lawsuit. At that point, aren't you assumed to have knowledge of everything that's in that file? Is it required for me to physically, let me finish the question, Ms. Aguilar, to go down to the courthouse, which now gives the defendant another obligation, to look through a file to ascertain what's in there to actually receive notice? She's served. All parties are served. They then become fully aware of everything that's in the party. Can open it up on my computer and see it on iDocket.
2 points. First, the most you could get out of that order was an anticipation that Judge Pate would be assigned. Because as I mentioned earlier, the order of assignment has to come from Judge Metairie, the assigning judge.
Metairie, just so I can correct you. Well, if she was here, she'd correct you, so I thought I'd do her the...
and the second part is... In terms of getting notice of everything in the file, you don't. For example, let's say they also want to send discovery.
When is the order signed by Judge Metairie?
I'm sorry?
What is the date of order signed by Judge
Metairie? It's on May 6th. But that was just put in the file, and I'm not sure when it actually got submitted to the court. It was after Judge Rincones' order.
Well, this says the order of assignment for Judge Pate, according to the record that I look, was signed and filed with the district clerk May 6th. So it's in the clerk record. It's notice. I can open it up. I can see it. Your client can open it up and see it. Everybody can see it at that
There's
point.
There's a difference between implied notice and actual notice. Implied notice might be that, yeah, they should go look, or they should have some kind of notice, but actual notice is very different. And in this case, for example, let's say instead they had also filed written discovery in the court. Would that be good enough to say that now they have to answer that discovery with a certain point if they don't serve them with copies of that discovery?
Well, the discovery rules are different in the sense that the discovery rule says you have to serve them. This doesn't say you have to serve the party. Well, it just says they have to have actual notice.
And that's where.
And I think that there's a lot of case law out there, Mr. Aguilar, that says that notice in the file is notice to the party.
There is a lot of. I know there's a lot of case law that says notice in the files, notice to the party, but that's once they become parties. At this point, we had not even filed an answer.
Y'all hadn't filed an answer. See that? I mean, let's say you get served with something, but you haven't even hired a lawyer, and activities happening in the file. I mean, you as a client don't have the obligation to go and look at the file. Now, once an attorney's retained, which I assume you got retained, and then you did the responsible thing, is you actually looked in the file.
Which is what an attorney does, not necessarily what an individual party does.
Well, yeah, but this doesn't say the attorney has to have actual notice. This is the party has to receive actual notice.
But how does a party have actual notice if the party has not retained counsel?
Well, I don't think that actual. I don't think there's any case law that ties actual notice to retention of counsel. Actual notice. The rules aren't made for lawyers. The rules are made for the parties and who the party has to follow. Now, you could make the argument that is service actual notice of the party.
Well,
go ahead.
I think. Well,
you chime in now.
Well, I'll ask a question. Does that frustrate the notice requirement because, or are you saying it frustrates the notice requirement because, one, you can wait months before you serve someone sometimes, and then you have 20 days after the Monday next to file an answer, and if the judge was assigned the next day, then...
Exactly. They could take advantage of that.
They would never actually get a chance to do that because they could wait 7 days before they serve you.
Before they even tried to serve them, which would make it
automatic. Do you agree with that?
I agree. That would certainly be a problem.
But that's between having the person in the party and then serving them. They serve. I agree with that. Yeah. I agree that you can't have you. You're just a name party. It doesn't give you notice. The question is, does service then make you give you notice of everything that's in the court's file at that point?
And
do you have to actually wait to file an answer?
Because the statute references actual notice instead of presumed notice by you should have been able to go look at the file or something like that, it requires actual notice. I think the court's been pretty clear that it requires you to actually get notice instead of just assume that they could have gotten notice. I'd like to move on to the next issue because I've only got about 2.5 minutes left.
Go, quick.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless you have any other specific questions on this section, and obviously I'll have to be very quick on this, but basically the second point is that De Leon is entitled to dismissal under 101-106. The two main cases we've been referencing are Texas Bay Cherry Hill, and the second one is Hopkins, both of which they sued an individual, either a mayor or a commissioner. Both of them, they tried arguing that I'm just going after the individual, and the courts both said that even though you try suing them only in their individual capacity, that doesn't disqualify them as an employee. Whether they sued in their individual or official capacity is irrelevant because 101-106 presumes that they are being sued in their official capacity. And in this case, the whole question comes back to whether the allegations involve the same subject matter and suit could have been brought against the city. Suit could have been brought against the city only means it's in tort as opposed to under the Workers' Compensation Act, under the Whistleblower Act, or something else. That's what the Supreme Court in Franca said. That's what it means by could have been brought against the city. And involving the same subject matter, in this case, all their allegations, that's why I mentioned at the very beginning, all their allegations are that De Leon did certain things in city commission meetings, and that caused the city to break their contract and create a new contract. Everything they're talking about was within his actions as a city commissioner. Because those are so closely related, De Leon is entitled to dismissal on his claims. The fact that they also argue that De Leon is no longer employed doesn't matter. That's like saying, okay, that guy who hit me in the car crash, who was a city employee, he's not employed anymore, so he's not going to be our employee. We're not responsible. Bailey, specific Supreme Court case, Bailey said that doesn't matter whether he's no longer an employee.
You look at when it happened, right?
Right, you look at when it happened. I mean,
counsel, I still want to go back to one more question on your prior issue before, I guess,
that's
maybe
fine.
Justice G.
Well, that's pretty much all I wanted to say on that anyway.
Justice Inhofe, you can have as much time as you want.
Okay, I just want to, I have one question regarding that. In this case, the party was non-suited. The party that made the objection was non-suited. How does that preserve your disqualification issue?
You mean by nobody else objected?
Yes.
That doesn't matter. I mean, it happened like the Supreme Court had said in Canales, is that as soon as there's that objection, it's automatic. It doesn't matter whether, put it this way, let's say instead of being dismissed in 2 months, they were dismissed 3 years later. Now everybody had been relying, well, they already dismissed it and whatever. Can the other parties appeal on the same basis? Obviously, yes. The Supreme Court has said it's automatic as soon as that objection is made. There's no need for anybody else to object. So whether
even if they dismiss or non-suit that party afterwards.
Right. As Justice DeHirina explained a while ago, think of the assumption of we'll just let you lay back. You can object. It's going to be denied. Lay back on the log or whatever that term is.
Behind the log.
Lay behind the log, and then I'll dismiss you in 3 years, and then it'll be too late for anybody else to do anything. It's easy to imagine how somebody could take advantage of that circumstance, and that's why the Supreme Court says it's immediate and automatic.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Sorry. I was rereading my notes, so I knew what questions to ask, Mr. Sills.
May it please the court, Travis Sales for Appalese, Brantsville GMS, and Michael Bennett. Appellant Mr. DeLeon brings two basic appellate points. Both are incorrect. First, the court has already been discussing at length the objection by Ms. Tetro to visiting Judge Robert Pate. The point is incorrect for three specific, very independent reasons. First, and we've also submitted to the court a timeline that Mr. Aguilar responded to. First, under 74.053, the objection has to be made within 7 days of the actual notice. It is undisputed on the record in this case that on May 6th, the petition was filed, the TRO was granted, a TRO order was signed, and on May 7th, Ms. Tetro and Mr. DeLeon were served with citation that attached to that an order that said, and it was unequivocal, the TI will be heard by Judge Robert Tate. They received actual notice, and the assignment, as Justice Benavides has noted, was filed on May 6th. So they had received service with an attached actual notice to the party, and it was in the file, assigned proper assignment. And Your Honors, the case law is very clear that there is no formal service of a assignment of judge necessary. In fact, there's been cases where it just said in open court, an oral statement by a judge that some other judge is going to hear the case constitutes. So there's no argument here that they did not receive actual notice under the law to a party. Second, Your Honor, the independent reason number two that this qualification has no merit is the parties proceeded and there was a TRO granted. Obviously, it was going to dissolve by its merits. We were desperately, on behalf of GMS, trying to work with the City of Brownsville, the commissioners, and the council to extend that by agreement so we could get an orderly TI hearing and have some discovery. They had filed motions to quash discovery that we were seeking. They were trying to run out the clock on us. And we knew what was going to happen. If the clock ran out, they were ready with City Council to go over and jam this other contract that had violated 252 and the Open Meetings Act down. And once the law was clear, once that contract was signed and executed under government immunity, the horse is out of the barn. It's very difficult to put it back. So we filed substantive motions for an extension of the TRO, for a motion to hear to the motion to quash. And we've been hearing that from counsel, well, Judge then sua sponte granted. That's not a sua sponte order. There was a pending substantive motion before the court.
But don't you actually have to have a hearing? I mean, according to 74.05, it says before the date, the first hearing or trial. It kept getting extended, so you hadn't had a first hearing or trial.
Respectfully, Justice Benavides, the case law is very clear that you do not actually have to have an oral hearing. As long as there is something of merit or substance before the court, the other side has a chance to respond. This was a duly filed motion. They had notice. And again, We're going to talk about the gamesmanship. The case law says you do not have to have that. In fact, the Perkins case that decided, Your Honor.
But it says commences. That's the word I get hung up. Before the date of the first hearing or trial, including pretrial hearings, commences whenever date occurs earlier. Doesn't commences say, well, as long as the judge hasn't basically she or he opened her mouth or said, I'm now hearing, they have the time to object up till that point, no matter how many times you've set a hearing.
No, Your Honor. Not
as long as the 7 days.
With all respect, that's not the case. Once the substantive motion was on file, they had a right to respond. They knew, first of all, they had actual notice that it was before Judge Tate. We were working with Judge Tate to try to get the parties in front of him, and there was a substantive ruling there, and that constitutes.
So let me ask you, that yes. Are you disagreeing with counsel saying that it was not sua sponte and that his letter order, and I haven't seen it, but I'm going to presume that it's there unless you tell me it's not there, but a letter order was responsive to your motion?
Yes.
Or was it responsive to his sua sponte, I need to change it because I'm not going to be available?
It was not a sua sponte order, Your Honor. It was in response to our motion requesting for an extension. It was in response to the urgency of the situation. There were motions pending.
Let me see if I can get these dates right, Mr. Sells. So when the order, with the copy of the petition and the copy of the TRO, it already had a set hearing in there, right? Has to.
Right.
What date was that hearing set for originally before he said he wasn't available? Do you remember?
May 20th, I believe, Your Honor.
May what?
May 20th, I believe, Your Honor.
All right.
So it was going to basically expire by operation of law because the judge wasn't going to be available.
Right, so we were trying to move to get an extension of the TRO. We were trying to work by agreement, and we couldn't because, frankly, they were just running out the clock on us. And so let me move on to the third reason, which is very clear as well. With all due respect to my colleague, Mr. Aguilar, the law is very clear on this point, including cases from this court in the Alvarez case, the Collins case out of the 14th Court in Houston, the Bose case out of the 1st Court of Houston, the Sweetwater Austin Properties case out of Austin, all recent, fairly recent cases, that an objection to a visiting judge is waivable. And the only case that they cite, it is not subject matter jurisdiction, which is non-waivable. Here, Ms. Tetreault objected, not timely, not within 7 days, after an order by the court, so it wasn't valid. But even if it was, no other party ever objected to this to Judge Pate. They never joined that objection. We proceeded to have substantive motions, a full-blown trial on the TI, subsequent motions to dismiss filed by Mr. De Leon. Never once was on the record or in the filings, we joined this or we're proceeding under reservation. And the key distinction between the In re Parrott case that Mr. De Leon solely relies upon for this point, In re Parrott was a Supreme Court case in 99, so there's lots of cases afterwards, first of all, dealing with this issue. But it says there you had two franchisees suing a franchisor. One franchisee objects to a visiting judge. The other does not. Within 7 days of the one that objected, the other one mandamused the judge. And what the court said there was, under these rare and unusual circumstances, it made no difference because both parties were still in the case. They took immediate action to proceed to protect the right to object to the judge. And under those rare and unusual circumstances, it was not waived. And the language about void is, yes, if in fact there was a proper objection that was timely, that was within 7 days before an order, and it was preserved, then, yes, subsequent orders by that judge would be void. But it is not waivable. It is not a subject matter situation where everything he does, if some party objects. And here, the case law is very legion, Your Honors, that we talk about the purpose of 74.053 is to avoid gamesmanship. And with all due respect here, this is a classic case of that. What they did was, after Ms. Tetreault objected, she was non-suited because she provided proof that she'd filed her conflict of statement interest, so we non-suited her. Neither the City of Brownsville nor any of the other commissioners nor Mr. De Leon ever raised the objection, proceeded, and they were hopeful that they were going to get a favorable ruling from Judge Pate. And we went on and we spent unbelievable amount of time, effort, and very hard-fought battles, and they lost. The first time that either of those parties ever raised this issue was on appeal here. 4 months after Ms. Tetreault's objection. And under all those cases that are recent, that are after the language cited by in the Canales case, after the Parrott case, courts of appeals around this state have noted clearly that under these circumstances, that objection is not preserved. It's waived.
So when you had the actual hearing on the injunction, they didn't say, Your Honor, with all due respect, we're still relying on, you know, that objection to you, and we don't believe we should go forward. So they never brought it up.
Exactly, Your Honor. In fact, what they should have done, you know, and that's what in Ray Parrott, if they really believed that that was a valid objection, they should have mandamused the judge. They didn't. Second, at least file some type of motion or put on the record, we're proceeding under protest, and we are reserving this right. And judge, be on notice that you may be wasting a lot of time and effort of the parties and all this. But you can't lay behind the log and say, I think I've got an ace in the hole back here that someday if Judge Pate disagrees with me, I get a free bite and see if I can win on the merits. But if he disagrees with me, then I get to king exit and go back to square one.
Let me ask you, so you're telling me that, or telling us that when they were served with, when the city was served, it actually had an order with Judge Pate being assigned?
On the order, the TRO was attached to the citation was the order saying the temporary injunction will be heard, and quote, be heard before the Honorable Robert C. Pate Judge. Yes, he was.
So why doesn't that constitute notice?
It did. That's right. I think it absolutely did. That was actual notice to the party. It wasn't even in the file on the assignment with the citation. The parties, Ms. Tetreault.
Well, he makes the argument, though, that according to the rule, the assignment has to be given actual notice. And if you read the statute, you can make that argument is valid, that receives actual notice of the assignment. I mean, that's what the statute says. It doesn't say actual notice of. So do we read that to say an assignment? I mean, I don't know what that means. We're all having this discussion this morning. Do we have to actually have the notice of the assignment, the order signed by Judge Missy Madary or whatever presiding judge is?
No, Your Honor. That's what I was trying to say, probably inartfully, and I apologize. But there is cases we've cited in our briefs that you could have just an oral statement in court. There's no formal requirement of a formal service of the assignment itself. It's actual notice that you have a judge other than the duly seated judge of that court is going to be hearing this case. At that point in time, you have a duty. If you want to object to that judge, you have 7 days to do it or before the first hearing.
So the 7 days would have been from the 7th forward.
Yes, ma'am.
And that was,
as we point out in our brief, that's 9 days later they object, only again after they've had this, the run out the clock has not worked. Then we get this objection. And then the others wait. Let me turn briefly, I know my time is short, let me turn briefly to the more merits of the motion to dismiss. Judge Pate rightfully denied the motion to dismiss under 101.106F of the Texas Torts Claims Act, Texas Civil Practice Remedies Code 101.106F, because there's two elements that Mr. De Leon must prove to be able to be dismissed in that situation. Number one, that the allegations evidence before that were presented show that he was acting within the course and scope of his employment, and it's conjunctive, and the cause of action brought against Mr. De Leon could not have also been brought against the city of Brownsville. He fails on both points. Number one, we have ample allegations and ample evidence in the record here that Mr. De Leon was certainly not acting in this course and scope of his employment. We've cited the Minyard case, Supreme Court case. The course and scope, you need to be acting on behalf of your employer for your employer. We cite the case law, the Supreme Court case that says you can't, it's like the distinction between, on a slander case, slandering someone to a fellow employee is not acting for the city. It's the difference between slandering for the city to someone else. Here, the evidence was off the record, off duty. Mr. De Leon was caught on tape bragging about how he was effing going to stop GMS, and he did stop GMS. We have evidence that he was working, we believe, implicitly with Redfish to send out material information that was very damaging to GMS while this was all going on.
But wasn't all of that, as done, still what is what gives them protection under the Texas Civil Rights Remedies, that once you sued the city of Brownsville in his official capacity, you can't sue him? I mean, isn't the same action?
We didn't sue him for his official. We sued him in his individual capacity. And he wasn't even a city council person anymore, a commissioner anymore. So he's the individual capacity. And no, Your Honor, because we were not suing him for what he did in his normal course and scope of his employment as a city commissioner. Outside of his work, he was sabotaging. The record was that he complained on the record that my client, GMS, had not given him a $15,000 campaign contribution. There was evidence and allegations that he was out to sabotage GMS outside the context of this. And, in fact, this court has recognized in the La Jolla School District case that it's a little bit different context, but a statute, but very similar context, that if somebody's trying to bribe, and there was a change in the broker insurance contract with who was going to be the broker, and the allegation was that some of the people on the board were working with a different broker and getting paid, and the allegation was, well, you're just suing them in their job as being on the board, voting to who gets to become the new insurance broker. They said, no, that was easy. That's not acting for your employer. That's acting for your own personal benefit.
I believe that was my case, but...
Yes.
what were you doing? I believe that was mine. But isn't this... what you're complaining about is... Yes, maybe he's a bad person, bad actor, and does bad things, but you're complaining about his vote and how he somehow participated in trying to get his fellow commissioners to vote against your client. Isn't that basically what you're complaining about?
No.
What he did in his official capacity by not... voting in your favor, or
no, Your Honor, and it's similar to the La Jolla case, because they voted in their official capacity, but they were voting because they had their own private interest at stake, as opposed to the interest of the public there. Here, very similarly, Mr. De Leon was out to sabotage GMS. It's very clear on the record. It was very clear the evidence there. And we have plenty of allegations. This is just right now that a motion to dismiss stage. Before, and it was pretty clear, and Judge Payton made the poignant comment that it's pretty clear the way this all worked out and it affected the city's plea to the jurisdiction. He wanted to avoid like heck having the discovery as to what was going on here. And that's what really is going on. And what he was doing was off the record, off the course and scope, acting for his own personal benefit and gain, and there's plenty of allegations about TOMA violations with Mr. De Leon as well. And all that goes to show that that's outside the course and scope. It's not just a matter of vote. It's what he was doing around that in the press, in the neighborhood, off the record, in violation of TOMA. Those things were all off the record. The second element, by the way, in which they cannot meet, is that we sued Mr. De Leon for tortious interference with the GMS contractual relationship with the city of Brownsville. By definition in black letter law, we could not sue the city for tortious interference with its own contract or its own contractual relationships. The second element is you must be able to have brought that same case against the city. We could not. And in fact, the Cherry Hill case that Mr. Aguilar brought up is completely distinguishable, because it's actually right on point, because there the suit involved an allegation that the city had badmouthed an apartment complex, or one of the commissioners had badmouthed an apartment complex, and the suit was, you interfered with the apartment complex's relationship with their tenants. So you could have sued the city there in his official capacity, because it involved a third-party contract.
The city wasn't a party.
Right, right. It wasn't their contract. Yeah. It was the apartment complex's contract with the tenants. And so it was completely distinguishable here, the retort we've heard as well, there are some cases out there dealing with whether or not you could still sue the city and it not be valid under government immunity. But the difference there is you have to be able to state a viable cause of action in the first instance. We could not state a viable cause of action against the city for tortious interference with itself. And so it is an independent, for two independent reasons, the motion to dismiss was correctly denied by Judge Pate.
Wouldn't that subject city council members, county commissioners, and other things to tortious interference cases where they just don't like a certain provider. I'm not saying I agree with the things that I read in the briefs. I know that there were some pretty egregious things that were said that will be played out in a court of law, but doesn't that really subject them all? If someone doesn't agree with a vendor and wants to vote against them and has some real animosity towards them, does it open them up for lawsuits like this one?
No, Your Honor, and I will point out that there's recent, this Lavery versus Weatherby case, Supreme Court case of 2017, which adopts the fact that you can't sue somebody in their official capacity with some subjective intent, which is your concern, some bad motive, and make them prove that, and I see my time's up, but if I can respond to the question.
Sure.
You can't turn the burden of proof on the individual city commissioner or government official and say, prove that you didn't, I allege you have bad intent, you don't like my client, and that's enough to go forward. No, the court said you can't do that. This is not that case because as you correctly recognize, we have objective evidence here of not only bad intention, but bad action. The action actually happened on the record, bragging about off the record how he stopped GMS. And he stopped it because they didn't give him a $15,000 campaign contribution.
Did he say, I stopped them or I'm going to stop them?
He said, I effing stopped them. Excuse my language, I'm trying to quote it correctly. I effing stopped GMS. And so I think that takes it out of that context where the concern of the Supreme Court, and I think Your Honor's concern, that, well, you could just sue somebody and say, I don't, you know, and go forward with a trial and say, hey, this person didn't like me, and I can go forward and relitigate their mental state about that. You can't do that. You have to have objective evidence of bad action, and then you can proceed. And we have that here.
Okay, Mr. Stiles. Any other further questions?
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
So why don't we talk about the second issue, since you didn't get to talk about it as much in the first time. Why is this not exactly what he can't be sued for?
You mean Tort Claims Act issue?
The Tort Claims Act issue.
Before I do that, I would like to mention just briefly.
Briefly.
I'm just going to, this one point. Mm-hmm. Henry Canales says, a motion requesting affirmative, for 74053 to apply, you need a motion requesting affirmative relief, a judge who considers the merits of arguments and a ruling on the matter. The judge's order said, the court has advised the parties that the court is not available for hearing on temporary injunction originally scheduled on this matter. Accordingly, for good cause, the court extends a temporary restraining order, et cetera. That's at 1419. It's clear that they were not ruling on any consideration of the merits of the arguments. Now, I'll get off of that. As far as the 101-106 issue goes, what they seem to overlook is 101-106 is not on the merits. It is not a merits issue. It's an election of remedies issue. I disagree with a lot of what he says. The reference to the recording was never proved up. That recording was never established, that it was even Mr. De Leon, but that doesn't matter. I disagree with a lot of his evidence. I don't want the court to think that, yeah, all that happened. We disagree with a lot of that. But regardless of that, what he's trying to say is we couldn't sue the city for these items. That doesn't matter. What Garcia said, which also came out of this court, Garcia said is that, look, that was a case where they were trying to sue under the workers' comp statute and said, look, we can't sue the city. They said, it doesn't matter. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is when it's something that could have been brought against the city, means that it's a suit in tort rather than under another statute. Could have been brought doesn't mean the city could be found liable for it. Franca specifically said that. When they're alleging everything arose out of the same, what I refer to as the operative nexus of operative facts, that's what they're complaining about, whether it was the city or the individual. They're saying what he was doing was in his capacity to the city. All this stuff that they're saying about the sabotaging and outside stuff, that's not what they're suing for. They're saying stuff like that happened, but what they're suing for is that what they say he did in the city commission meetings as an official. Because of that,
how about this tortious interference cause of action? Tortious interference is, they're saying you know, you, but for your actions, we would have had a contract, and your tortious interference didn't occur at the meeting. It occurred outside the meeting when you were bad-mouthing, or I guess...
No.
You know.
They're not saying that. They're not saying what happened at a... What that conversation apparently had to do with...
Well, aside of the conversation.
It was a conversation. That's all it was, is at a branch. Some guys were sitting around drinking beer and started talking, and one of them was recording it.
Well, and that was after the fact.
Right.
That was so, after it already happened.
And there's no reference to anything that happened before those meetings.
And there's no allegations? They're not making allegations that he was working with Redfin?
Oh, they might be making some... In other words, you have the normal conspiracy, everybody's out to get me, and they were doing this for bad reasons or whatever. But all he's complaining about that Mr. De Leon allegedly did occurred at those meetings. Bay Cherry Hill said, any motivations that he might have had is really irrelevant. The question is what capacity he was in when he was doing the things they're complaining about.
How do you distinguish the Trevino case, La Jolla, Trevino versus La Jolla case, which is a case that I wrote a while back. I don't remember exactly everything, but I remember that one.
I actually don't remember that case. I don't know if it was even cited in the briefs. I just don't remember what happened in that case to be able to respond. Basically, what all the cases we've cited would tell you is that what you look at is whether he was in the scope of his employment for the things about which they complain. And the scope of his employment was the only thing they complain about is that he interfered, he canceled one contract, and he acted to cancel one contract, and he acted to establish another contract. That's the only thing they're complaining about. Whatever else he might have done, whatever motivations he might have had, don't come into play. What they're complaining about is his actions. It's the actions that he did that they can sue for, whether it's a tortious interference or whether he was negligent in with an auto accident, whatever it is. It's really just the actions that they have a cause of action for, and they have not identified anything outside of that meeting, of those two meetings. And because of that, because he's in the scope of his employment and what they're alleging at that point, that's why they can't sue him under the tort claim. He's entitled to immunity and dismissal under 101-106.
Okay. Any further questions from the panel? The case will be under submission.
Thank